Now stay tuned for Taking Aim with Ralph Shulman and Maya Shelton.
Ralph Shulman Ben.
And Maya Shone, coming to you Tuesday, April 1st, 2003. Against all odds, the resistance of the oppressed. As Robert Fisk was reporting on March 27th in The Independent, it was an outrage, an obscenity. The severed hand on the metal door, the swamp of blood and mud across the road, the human brains inside a garage, the incinerated skeletal remains of an Iraqi mother and her three small children in their still smoldering car. One man, so shocked by the headless corpses he had just seen, could say only two words. Roar! Flash! He kept saying, and then closed his eyes so tight that the muscles rippled between them. If this is what we are seeing in Baghdad, Robert Fisk asks, what is happening in Basra and Nasiriyah and Karbala? How many civilians are dying there, too, anonymously, indeed unrecorded, because there are no reporters to be witness to their suffering? Robert Fisk in Baghdad reporting about the two missiles from an American jet slamming down on Baghdad. This among the more than 6,000, is it? 800 missiles one day, 1,500 missiles another day, Baghdad under siege.
And Maya, those two missiles that you were describing as reported by Robert Fisk pertain to one street on Abu Talib Street. But it is not in that location alone that the missiles continue to rain. The constant litany in the captive press, the embedded press, would have us believe that they are, quote, softening up, unquote, the troops of the Republican Guard or the defenders of Baghdad on the outskirts of the city. But in fact, whole sections of the city are being targeted. Abu Hassan and Malek Hamoud were preparing lunch for customers at the Nasser restaurant. A missile that killed him landed next to the westbound carriageway. The blast tore away the front of the cafe. Fellow workers led me through the rubble. This is all that is left of the occupants, he said, holding out before me an oven pan dripping with blood. 15 cars burst into flames in another location, burning many of their occupants to death. Missiles hit neatly on an eastbound carriageway, sending shards of metal into men and to standing outside a concrete apartment block. The reports go on. This is a daily occurrence. It is not just an isolated event. It is the constant. The siege of Baghdad. Peter Arnett. And let us say something here about Peter Arnett. Arnett, who went on television in Iraq to state that the war that had been planned by the Pentagon as a cakewalk had been a miscalculated war, and the resistance of the Iraqi people was inspiring opposition across the world. This is a fact. This is a statement of reality. This is a description that the authorities don't want heard, and so he is attacked ad nauseam, and he is forced to apologize and dismissed from NBC, the captive press indeed.
Ralph, it's interesting that when this was first reported on CNN, NBC at first defended Arnett and said that his presentation had been analysis. Then NBC must have been flooded with calls, or flooded with calls, I would assume, from the U.S. Pentagon, not flooded with calls from the people of the United States who were engaged in massive anti-war demonstrations.
Well, actually, Maya, the siege of Baghdad, as reported by MSNBC by Peter Barnett, is as follows. The huge firearm mushroom clouds rise over Baghdad. What you see on your television screens, thanks to the much maligned Al Jazeera network camera, signal Signals, Arnett stated, the intensification of a reign of death. The siege of Baghdad has begun, announced by the lobbing from great heights of bunker buster bombs that throw shrapnel and tiny slivers of steel in all directions and slice through human flesh. Hailed at the war's beginning by gushing heads for precision, these smart weapons fail to distinguish between civilians and so-called military, between Iraq and Iran and Syria. The bomb, Peter Arnett describes, the bombs that destroyed the working-class centers of Baghdad continue to fall. This is his crime, the reporting accurately of the consequences of this genocidal war.
And U.S. teams seek to kill Iraqi elite. Covert missions target Hussein's inner circle. This is a report by Dana Priest in the Washington Post, Saturday, March 29th. We've reported before how President Bush has authorized CIA killer squads working in tandem with Delta Force and other special forces. Killer squads, CIA paramilitary division. Many people think of the CIA as an intelligence operation. Yet the CIA has its own paramilitary special ops group, and they are throughout Baghdad now. They include snipers, demolition experts, schooled in setting house and car bombs.
Maya, this report in Glasgow by Scotland on Sunday. U.S. assassins kill Iraqi chiefs in Baghdad. American special forces have assassinated senior Iraqi officials in a series of sniper attacks in Baghdad and other cities, it was revealed today. American government sources said that in the past week of covert operations, many Republican Guard commanders, Ba'ath Party officials, and opponents of the United States have been killed. CIA officials confirm, and Pentagon spokeswoman Victoria Clark said, we have special forces in the north, the west, and the south of the country. These undercover teams carry sophisticated weapons and communications equipment capable of receiving real-time targeting intelligence to guide them to the locations of individuals to transmit information about their targets with similar speed. SAS commander Clive Fairweather stated that special forces are operating in cities across Iraq. This is talk about a terror campaign, the U.S. terror campaign across Iraq of assassination.
Yes, Ralph, but Victoria Clark, while she's saying they're taking out this member of the Iraqi elite and that a member, who knows if this is at all true? For instance, one day they reported that they had a high-ranking Iraqi general, and the next day it was found that this wasn't so. One day they say they've captured and taken hold of one city after another in Iraq, and then it turns out that the Iraqi people are resisting, that they have not taken hold of these cities. In fact, they only have the port through which they will export oil.
As you say, Maya, but assassins they remain. And assassination is their objective, and terror, state terror, is their method. Here's the London Observer on Sunday, Peter Graham in Baghdad, bloodied, still unbowed, Baghdad prepares to fight. When the bombs fall at night, Muhtana Muhammad Saleh wakes up and sings into his microphone. His call of Allah Akbar from the minaret of the mosque mingles with the bombs that boom around the city. Muhtana is more reliable than the air raids, with targets destroyed early on, knocking out telecom exchange with bunker-busting missiles. The minaret sounds the alarm to the population that responds to the call. The first ring of defense around the city is already geared up to fight a guerrilla war. During the drive yesterday afternoon, a third of the way down the highway to Karbala and Najaf, we found camouflage tanks, sandbag bunkers, defended with heavy machine guns, mobile anti-aircraft trucks. Within a few days, this area will be the front line. But throughout the small villages and the farmland, throughout the areas surrounding Baghdad, throughout Baghdad itself, the people prepare to resist. And indeed, the article describes the impact throughout the Arab world, not only of the bloodbath, but of the resistance.
Ralph, 60% of Iraq's population of 24 million are Shiites who have long been marginalized politically, the Sunnis making up the ruling elite. And the United States had speculated, had depended upon the Shiite population in the south of Iraq, for instance, where Basra is located, to rise up. As Nora Bustani in the Washington Post notes on Sunday, March 29th, the U.S. Pentagon expected the Shiites to embrace, that's the word she uses, embrace U.S. and British troops with a shower of rice and rose petals. But the reality is otherwise. As reported in An-Nahar by columnist Salem Mashkour, he talked about what is actually happening with the Iraqi Shiites. In fact, last Tuesday, Mohammed Bakr Hakim, the head of the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, which is the primary Shiite opposition group, said that his forces, the Badr Brigade, would retaliate against, quote, the American invasion because the war was one of, quote, aggression. The Shiites themselves consider that the invasion of U.S. and British troops are an aggression and invasion against the Iraqi people.
And indeed, Maya, Ayatollah Mohammed Bakir al-Hakim, in his news conference, as you describe, called for the removal of all U.S. and British troops as soon as possible and called upon the Shiite population and upon Iraqis at large, resist. Resist by all means available. Resist by force of arms. Drive these foreign forces out. Do not allow them to become occupiers. The Shiite people of Iraq, the resistance to Saddam Hussein itself, is now a resistance in defense of the nation, in defense of the people, in defense of the oppressed, a resistance to imperialism, a resistance to U.S. aggression, a resistance to occupation, and it is spreading throughout the Arab world. Outrage spreads in the Arab world. The Washington Post describes from Cairo, civilian deaths are called a massacre, a shuddering sense of outrage that Bush and the United States fell over the Arab world today as television networks and newspapers report the U.S. air assault. The monstrous martyrdom in Baghdad states a huge headline in Al-Dastur in Amman, Jordan. The dreadful massacre in Baghdad in Iraq reads the banner headline in Egypt's mass circulation in Akhbar al-Yom. Yet another massacre by this coalition of invaders read the main headline in Saudi Arabia's most popular newspaper, the Al Riyadh Daily. Mr. Bush has lost us. We are gone. Enough. This is the end, said Dia Rasham, head of the Comparative Politics Unit at the Al-Ahram Center for Political and Strategic Studies in Cairo. If America should start winning tomorrow, we will have suicide bombings all over the Arab world. This is a clear sign. Bush is an occupier. Bush is a terrorist. He thinks he is playing a video game, said George Al-Khnaba, an Arab Christian and the owner of a supermarket in Amman. We hate the Americans. We hate the United States. We hate the government of George Bush. We hate this invasion. We will resist it. And this, the Washington Post described, is spreading throughout the Arab East. Demonstrations were banned in universities in Egypt, but 10,000 students walked out in Alexandria as demonstrations are now spreading across the Arab world, city after city, country after country.
And a good example of this is Syria. Syria, as reported in The Guardian by Jonathan Steele, who is based in Damascus. On Friday, March 28th, he filed this report. Assad predicts defeat for invasion force. Mood of militancy grows. And Syria's president, Bashar al-Assad, became the first Arab leader, other than Saddam Hussein, to express the hope in public that U.S. and British forces invading Iraq would be defeated. He gave a front-page interview with Lebanon's Asafir newspaper, which is the primary newspaper in Beirut. He said, They might be able to occupy Iraq, but they wouldn't succeed in controlling it. Speaking of the British and the U.S. forces, quote, "For sure, the United States is a superpower that can occupy a relatively small country. The United States and Britain will not be able to control all of Iraq. There will be much tougher resistance." And again, in Syria, Sheikh Ahmed Kiftaro, the Grand Mufti of Syria, like the Shiite leader who we referred to before, he has called upon all Muslims to resist the U.S. and British invasion and sacrifice their life as martyrs if necessary. He said it was the duty of all Muslims to resist the U.S. and British forces. Quote, "All Muslims have to use all possible means of defeating the enemy, including martyrdom operations against the invading warriors." Now, this Grand Mufti in Syria is considered a moderate and venerable figure, according to Jonathan Steele in The Guardian. So here we have the moderate Grand Mufti calling upon the Muslims of the Arab East to say, resist, resist the occupiers. And as Ralph was mentioning, demonstrations in Egypt, in Syria also, where demonstrations require government support, there have been almost daily marches and sit-ins since the attack on Iraq, and close to 100,000 people took to the streets, and the Syrian government gave time off to government employees, university and high school students, so that they could attend the demonstration and parade through Damascus. It was the largest protest in the Arab world since the war began.
And it is spreading. It is in Morocco, where the government had banned demonstrations, and yet now in Rabat, demonstrations are daily, growing in number with every hour.
And that is why Colin Powell, Secretary of State Colin Powell, who had been a leader of the military strike against Iraq during the first Gulf War, Secretary of State Colin Powell has come out and warned Syria and Iran that they too would be targets if they continue with their opposition to the U.S. onslaught against Iraq. Targets? Targets, as already stated by Richard Pearl. Targets, as specified by Shimon Peres in Haaretz, in an article by Bradley Burstyn that appeared on March 20th. Could the U.S. be at war for years? Shimon Peres, who's a former prime minister, former foreign minister, a man who has been engaged in Israeli politics for tens upon tens and tens since the formation of the State of Israel, he said, "The war in Iraq is just the beginning. Problems of the first magnitude can be expected thereafter as well. Iran, North Korea, and Libya. 5 or 6 years at this point is what the U.S. is facing," he said. "I don't know how long it will take, but the problem is a global one."
The speech that Powell made, it's instructive to note, Maya, was before APEC, the main Zionist and Israeli lobby in the United States.
That's correct.
And it took place at a moment when Bush, under the cover of this war, has now authorized nearly $11 billion to the Israeli state. $11 billion to the Israeli state. And it's also interesting to note the reports in Haaretz, when it describes the anti-war demonstrations in Cairo and in other Arab cities, protests that were not authorized, eruptions that have led to scuffles between protests and security forces, protests that are that are becoming mass demonstrations. The decision in Cairo to close the universities indicates the significant fear that these clashes are spiraling out of control. That in Egypt, as in Jordan, the people are rising, and it is not to be surprised, particularly as the emergent news about the role of the Israelis in this conflict finds its way into the Arab press. Israeli-made missiles found in Baghdad. And Israel says space war. And an Israeli-made missile was found in Baghdad after U.S.-led bombardments of the capital. Israeli-made missiles were found amongst the missiles fired by the forces carrying out bombing raids. And indeed, in the in Newsday on the 28th of March, the Israeli arms connection. In the wreckage, Iraqis have found fragments with the manufacturer's signature, origin Tas Jerusalem, a taunting declaration fired from the Zionist state. As one of the world's top arms exporters, Israel has sold the United States an array of equipment that is being used and employed throughout Iraq. It has supplied the American military with sophisticated decoys, such as those found on Saturday. They have supplied precision air-to-surface missiles on the B-52 bombers, high-tech targeting systems, onboard computers, and the armor for the Bradley fighting vehicles rolling across the Iraqi desert.
Not only that, Ralph, Russian military reports who have been intercepting U.S., Israeli, and British radio communications, the Russian intelligence reports state that combat aircraft are taking off regularly from the Israeli air bases of Hatzarim and Navatim. Now, these have been possibly Israeli Air Force exercises, or they are U.S. planes that are taking off from these Israeli bases. Now, they believe that these really are both Israeli and U.S. F-17 stealth bombers that officially are supposed to be based at El Udeid Air Base in Qatar.
But in fact, Maya, the Russian military has reported that these Israeli air bases are the forward airfields and that the Anglo-American Air Force units are based there, and that the Israeli Air Force F-151 fighter bombers and the A-4N strike aircraft are operating from the Hatzarim Air Base, and that the F-16 fighter base bombers, which are in Iraq, are operating from the Nevatim base. So indeed, it's not just the F-117 stealth bombers nominally from Al Udeid, but the whole panoply of the Air Force assault is intimately linked to Israeli bases and the Israeli military-industrial complex.
I think, Ralph, that this is a good point to look at some of the weaponry that the U.S. is using against the Iraqi people. We have spoken over the past months about depleted uranium and the military toxic project, and Doug Roque, who had been part of the Pentagon's DU project. In fact, he was the man who was sent to the Gulf to clean up, supposedly, to investigate and clean up depleted uranium. And as a result, he considers depleted uranium a crime against humanity, and he himself is a victim of depleted uranium. But what we have now, after years and years of denial by the U.S. Pentagon, by the British military, by military throughout the world, and through the World Health Organization and other organizations, what we have now in the mainstream press in Europe is recognition of the horrors of the crime against humanity, as Doug Roque mentions, as the crime against humanity of the use by the United States and other countries of depleted uranium.
Well, Maya, what's especially important about the disclosures regarding depleted uranium, we have reported on it, we have written about it, we have orchestrated the information ever since not just the first Gulf War, but the war in the Balkans and against the people of Yugoslavia. On the 30th of March, the Sunday Herald in Glasgow, the United States force use of depleted uranium weapons. DU contaminates the land. It causes ill health. It causes cancer amongst the population, amongst the soldiers using the weapons. They target civilians. They lead to birth defects. And the article in the Sunday Herald in Scotland, which was also reported in The Guardian in London on March 29th by Richard Norton Taylor and Daniel Plesch, is very, very significant. The EU is responsible for Gulf War Syndrome, chronic muscle and joint pain, fatigue, and memory loss in over 200,000 U.S. sources. It is the cause of the increased number of birth deformities and cancer following the first Gulf War. Cancer has increased 10 times, deformities 6 times, according to a United Nations subcommission report to the Glasgow Sunday Herald. The Pentagon acknowledged that 320 metric tons of depleted uranium were left on the battlefield. Russian military experts state 1,000 metric tons is the more accurate figure. That number has been quadrupled in just the war that is the weaponry that has been unleashed in the short span of the current war in Iraq. In 1991, the article continues, the U.S. fired 944,000 depleted uranium rounds, over 2,700 tons of depleted uranium. The United Kingdom Atomic Energy Report stated that 500,000 people will die as a result of the radioactive debris left in the desert. Once again, 500,000 people will die, reported in the Sunday Herald in Glasgow, as a result of the radioactive debris left in the desert. The use of DU, this article continues, has led to birth defects in the children of Allied veterans and is the cause of a worrying number of ophthalmos cases, children, babies born without eyes in Iraq. Only 1 in 50 million births was an ophthalmic, yet in one Baghdad hospital, the Glasgow Sunday Herald reports, there were 8 cases. And it continues. A study of Gulf War veterans showed that 67% of Gulf War veterans have children with severe illnesses, missing eyes, blood infections, respiratory problems, and fused figures. This is not just an
fused
explosion.
Fingers.
Excuse me, what did I say? My
fingers,
excuse me. The Sunday Herald has exposed that the Ministry of Defense in Great Britain test fired 6,350 depleted uranium rounds in the Solway Firth in Scotland for over a decade. This is an exposure to the British public of the consequences of a real weapon of mass destruction, the tactical nuclear weapon of depleted uranium that is destroying generations in Iraq and poisoning the entire environment, to the detriment not only of the Iraqi people and the surrounding peoples, but to the soldiers who are there as cannon fodder as well.
As we've mentioned before, more than one-third, one out of three, of U.S. Gulf War veterans are now collecting benefits from the Veterans Administration, and this is acknowledged by the Veterans Administration, because of their combat duty in the Gulf. Now, Der Spiegel, the prominent German publication, on January 23, 2001, issued a report that depleted uranium was also used in Somalia and in tests throughout Germany. They said that examining the huge collection of files and electronic data stored at the Berlin Information Center for Transatlantic Security, the critic Otfried Nassauer discovered the fact that uranium munitions were used in Somalia, East Africa, a fact that was unknown until now. And also that the munitions company Rheinmetall admitted that they tested DU ammunition in Lower Saxony in the beginning of the 1970s. And in the upper Bavarian town of Schrobenhausen, the munitions company MBB tested DU ammunition for 17 years until 1996. 6.
Nor is this report about depleted uranium and its impact confined to the British press. On the 30th of March in Los Angeles Times, uranium warheads leave both sides a legacy of death for decades, is the headline. And I quote, of the 504,047 eligible veterans of the 1991 Persian Gulf War, about 29% are disabled, the highest rate of disability for any modern war. These guys, the article continues, rough, tough, buff, 20-year-olds a decade ago, are now suffering from a complex of debilities known as Gulf War Syndrome. And the article details how hundreds of thousands of tons of depleted uranium are lying around across Iraq, have contaminated the entire environment, are afflicting the population, over 100,000 Iraqi civilians, and many more than the 100,000 who died in the conflict are now afflicted by the consequences of depleted uranium, and indeed, as the article details, no less a crime, no less a crisis, no less a heartbreak is the impact on U.S. soldiers themselves and their families.
Against all odds, the resistance of the oppressed. You are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you over WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, listener-sponsored radio, and on the internet at www.wbai.org. We have a website for Taking Aim at www.wbaifree.org/taking aim. And on this website, you'll find an archive of our programs of the last few months. And included are special interviews that Bonnie Faulkner of KPFA's Guns and Butter did with Ralph and myself that are primers about the U.S. invasion of Iraq. So I recommend you go to www.wbaifree.org/taking aim. You can reach us at takingaim@pacbell.net or call us on our voicemail at WBAI 212-209-2953. Leave a message and we'll call you back. Against all odds, the resistance of the oppressed. And given what is taking place, how could the Iraqi people not but resist? Almost 86 years ago to the day, the British commander, Lieutenant General Stanley Maude, issued a proclamation to the people of Baghdad, whose city his forces had just occupied. "Our armies," he declared, "do not come into your cities and lands as conquerors, but as liberators." Within 3 years, 10,000 Iraqis had died in a national Iraqi uprising against the British rulers, who had gassed and bombed the insurgents. By the way, it was Winston Churchill in 1919 who had authorized the use of chemical weapons against the Arabs and the Kurds. On the eve of last week's invasion, writes Seamus Milne in The Guardian on March 27th, Lieutenant Colonel Tim Collins echoed Maude in a speech to British troops. Quote, "We go to liberate, not to conquer," he told them. "All the signs of the past few days," writes Seamus Milne, "are that a new colonial occupation of Iraq, however it is dressed up, will face determined resistance long after Saddam Hussein has gone, and that the occupiers will once again be driven out."
BBC on March 30th, eyewitness, Basra besieged. Who controls this city of 1.5 million encircled by British forces? There is little question about that. The Iraqi population, the Iraqi resistance, is in command of this city. Meanwhile, concern mounts for the civilians who are running out of food and water, directly resultant from the siege surrounding it. In an extraordinary report from the outskirts of the besieged city, in the Independent in London, the headline is Basra's Endless Human Tide. Thousands of Iraqis seek water as they leave their hometown. and more bizarrely, even more thousands seek to return to it. The people are seeking water and returning, and ever-increasing numbers of people are trying to enter Basra to join in the defense of the city, as The Independent reported on the 30th of March. "Why are the British soldiers treating us like this?" asked a young man called Adnan. "I am a petrochemical engineer. I want to return to Basra. I want to contact my family. We need liberty, not invasion. We shall resist." And that is the spirit, that is the mood, from the BBC to the Independent, to the Arab press itself, to every objective report. The people of Iraq are resisting an imperial invasion, a brutal occupation, a mass destruction of their country, with determination and will.
Ralph, also, besides depleted uranium, you had found a report that cluster bombs were being used against the Iraqi people. Now, in Lebanon, when Ralph and I were there in 1982 and 1983, cluster bombs, that is, bomblets, that were used throughout Lebanon and were left strewn throughout the fields, so that little, and some of them were made to look like toys, and children would pick them up after the immediate bombardment was over, and farmers would go out into their fields, and the children and the farmers would pick these things up thinking they were toys, and then there would be additional explosions. They would lose their arms. There would have to be amputations because of the terrible damage that was done to their limbs.
Maya, the International Tribunal on U.S. War Crimes in Indochina documented the persistent use of cluster bombs. Now, cluster bombs are little bomblets, and the mother bomb contains 250 cluster bombs, and each cluster bomb contains hundreds of slivers of razor-sharp steel that slice like a machete. Another type of cluster bomb, the bomblets contain BBs, and the fiendish character of these BBs is that they perforate organs. They render a liver and a pancreas like a sieve. The victims are inoperable. And as you describe, as we were living in the Palestinian camps during the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982, from one end of Lebanon to the other, throughout every Palestinian refugee camp, from villages across the south of Lebanon, right on through Sour, which is Tyre, through the port city of Saida, up to Baghdad itself. Cluster bombs littered the countryside, disguised as brightly covered balls, disguised as pens, disguised as cigarette lighters, disguised as telephone receivers, fiendishly intended to attract children, to attack peasants, to attack villagers who would pick these things up, and immediately they would be detonated. It was a weapon of terror. It's a weapon against the population. They are now being used in Iraq. They are being used in Baghdad. They are part of an arsenal aimed at demoralizing and at devastating the civilian population itself.
House to house. We know that in Baghdad, the U.S. Pentagon is preparing house to house and block to block. Meanwhile, throughout southern Iraq, U.S. Marines are doing house to house sweeps. Jonathan Feiner in the Washington Post reported on Sunday, March 30th, north of Nasiriyah, as 40 Marines walked toward a stone house in a frontline village here, a bearded man in a white robe emerges, his arms raised to show that he is unarmed. "Tell him we need to search the house," one of the Marines said. But what do these Marines do? They not only search the house, they say, according to the Marines, a harmless-looking home can be a, quote, hornet's nest. And what they do is they go in, they tear open the bags holding the grain, they sift through the contents, they open the cans of vegetable shortening, they strew everything throughout the house. They rampage throughout the house. And one of the Marines says, we're going to tear this place apart. And that is what they're doing, house to house, village by village, throughout the south of Iraq. Then, again in the Washington Post, lawlessness spreads in village. What do they mean? Roving bands of armed men come in to steal tractors, hijack trucks, loot the factories, and terrorize residents as the population of Iraq is disarmed. We saw this take place in Lebanon. The U.S. forces and European forces going in and taking away the arms that the Iraqis had to protect themselves. The villagers in Mush-Irji gathered behind the British Fusilier Zulu Company, complaining that the Operation Iraqi Freedom, which had promised them a better life, had only heightened their insecurity. Now thieves come, steal from the oil company based in this village, and they stole the air conditioners, the machines, the cars, the trucks. There are no more Iraqi police. No one can carry a pistol. It's a crime now. Disarming the population, creating havoc throughout the south of Iraq, as well as going in village and village, house by house, and rampaging through the homes of the Iraqi people.
Maya, you speak of theft. The thieves are out all right, and they're emanating from the capitalist circles in Washington, from the ruling class. The New York Times, March 29th, the oil prices end week higher on fears of protracted war. Oil prices registering their biggest one week leap in a year as markets grapple with the prospect of protracted war in Iraq. The market will take Iraqi oil out, John A. Shapiro, managing director and head of energy trading at Morgan Stanley, stated. Already on Thursday, the market received its first indication of when exports from Iraq may resume. The commander of the British forces in the Persian Gulf stated that Iraqi oil shipments can begin in 3 months from southern ports if $1 billion is invested in the Rumaila oil field now under the control of U.S. forces. That is to say, U.S. and British forces. What we're talking about here is the seizure of the largest oil field in Iraq, the bleeding of taxpayers of $1 billion to facilitate the profiteering from the stolen Iraqi oil.
$1 billion, Ralph, they are predicting they're going to invest $30 billion in the seizure of the oil of Iraq in order to up the production. But back to the house-to-house, the block-to-block, the takeover of the villages and the devastation of South Iraq. What you have here, according to the U.S. soldiers, and this is reported by Thomas Ricks in an article in the Washington Post, War Could Last Months, he refers to the Pentagon officials who talk about the taking of the Karbala Gap, where the Republican Guard are defending Baghdad. He says it's like shooting fish in a barrel or a turkey shoot. This is the way they refer to their mass murders. Now, also in the New York Times, an article by Dexter Filkins on March 29th, either take a shot or take a chance. He reports from Diwaniya in Iraq on March 28th. At the base camp of the 5th Marine Regiment here, two sharpshooters, Sergeant Eric Schrumpf, 28 years old, and Corporal Mikhail McIntosh, 20 years old, sat on a sand berm and swapped combat tales. For 5 days this week, the two men rode atop armored personnel carriers. We had a great day, Sergeant Schrumpf said. We killed a lot of people. We killed a lot of people. And then he described it. He added, we dropped a few civilians. But what do you do? He said he saw one Iraqi soldier standing among two or three people. And he and the other men in his unit, what did they do? According to Dexter Filkins reporting about their first-hand report from Sergeant Shrump, they opened fire. One of the women standing near the Iraqi soldier, what happened? She was murdered. The soldiers murdered her. I'm sorry, the sergeant said, but the chick was in the way.
Maya, this is a war that was prepared by the Israeli Likudniks and their allies in the ruling class, the Pearls and the Wolfowitzes, the Cheneys and the Rumsfelds, and they have sold this war to the American people on the ground that the people of Iraq would welcome them. Richard Pearl, who has resigned as chairman of the Defense Policy Board, it's a house of cards. They rule by fear. Support will collapse at the first whiff of gunpowder. Cheney, significant elements of the army will want to avoid conflict and will step aside as soon as the United States appears on the scene. Donald Rumsfeld, the course of the war is clear, the outcome is clear, the regime is gone, it's over. A relatively reasonable predicted period of time, they are ready to be liberated. Wolfowitz, the Iraqi people understand what the crisis is about. We don't come as a conqueror. We are there for their liberation. They will welcome us. And that pimp for the Imperium, the besotted Christopher Hitchens in Vanity Fair, this will be no war. It will be brief. The president will give an order. The attack will be rapid, accurate, and dazzling. It will be greeted by the majority of the Iraqi people as an emancipation. And I say, bring it on, says Christopher Hitchens in his cups.
And now you have the pimps for the Imperium going on CNN, MSNBC, and other stations announcing and wondering, is this Vietnam revisited? Is this Chechnya? And understanding that this is not a six-day wonder, as originally they had been referring to with the six-day war.
But Maya, the U.S. Army War College studies belie the propaganda of the proponents of permanent war. The war study stated the longer U.S. occupation of Iraq continues, the more danger exists that the Iraqi population will take violent measures to resist and to hasten the departure of U.S. forces. And indeed, the War College predictions are in an important paper called The Day After, The Army in a Post-Conflict, the Iraq. The War College Center for Strategic Leadership spoke of the necessity for hundreds of thousands of U.S. occupiers for a minimum of 5 years and likely as long as 10. In other words, Vietnam revisited on a scale not yet imagined by these epigons of imperialism.
An important article appeared in Telepolis. Top German military historians prophesy U.S. defeat. That's right, U.S. defeat. And this is available on the Internet. Contact us if you want to know the site. Professor Dr. Manfred Messerschmidt, 76 years old, until 1988, the head historian of the Military History Research Bureau. He's considered the doyen of German military history research. Now, Messerschmidt considers that a military defeat for the U.S. and British troops is probable. He said that a capture of Baghdad is impossible unless the U.S. and British forces, and around Baghdad it would be the U.S. forces alone, plan on laying the Iraqi capital in, quote, tremors and ashes. He said if you look at the Second World War, the 900-day siege of Leningrad, and you look at that in particular, as well as Stalingrad, that a street fight leads to complete destruction and horrible human losses. Now, at the Institute for Political Science at the University of Hamburg, there is also a military analyst section. And they also have been studying the war on Iraq. And Dr. Gerd Krumrach, who's a professor at the University of Dusseldorf, also sees it similarly. So you have three military analytical bureaus in Germany studying what is unfolding in Iraq, and all of them agree that not only that victory is not possible, but that then a siege of Baghdad will lay it to ashes. Tremor and ashes.
Maya the Progressive, on March 17th, the two Georges discover sanctions. On ABC's This Week, George Stephanopoulos, Clinton's spokesperson, George Stephanopoulos, and George Will discover the issue of economic sanctions and the terrible toll they have taken on Iraqi children. But as the article tells us, they did so in the most shameful way, to argue for war. The perverse nature of these Democratic and Republican spokespersons for imperial policy is such that they celebrate the sanctions as an argument for the need for massive bombardment and for shock and awe, because they say another 10 years of what is called containment under the United Nations will involve the slaughter of another 360,000 Iraqis, 240,000 of them children under five. And quote, the United Nations itself estimates that the current United Nations policy of trying to contain Saddam with economic sanctions kills 5,000 Iraqi children under 5 years of age every month. George Will said, responded to by George Stephanopoulos, and this is why it is necessary to have a massive war to end this quickly. The same theme was developed by Tony Blair, who stated the brutality of Saddam Hussein's regime may be measured that over the past 5 years, 400,000 Iraqi children under the age of five died of malnutrition and disease. Those statistics cited by the shameless Blair are United Nations statistics on the consequences of the sanctions. And here is John Bowser in the Los Angeles Times in his appropriately entitled Murderous Containment. And let this statement in this article by John Bowser in the Los Angeles Times of March 30th answer all those in the anti-war movement who talk about inspections and sanctions and the role of the United Nations. The killing of the Iraqis did not begin with this invasion or with George W. Bush, writes John Bowser. This has been underway for years, quietly, persistently, driven and administered by the United Nations, with bipartisan political support at home. Let us look at UNICEF. The sanctions have resulted in the needless death of over 500,000 Iraqi children under the age of five, 55,000 a year, 4,600 a month, 1,068 a week, 152 every day, day after day, week after week. That's as many dead youngsters each year as there were American servicemen killed in all of Vietnam. That's one baby out of every five born in Iraq during this era, with bipartisan support from both parties, with the United Nations as the vehicle for this murder. Balzar states this is a legitimized act of mass slaughter, sanctioned and administered by the United Nations. The UNICEF estimates of 500,000 child deaths do not even begin to tell the story of the consequences of this cutting off of all supplies, of medicines, antibiotics, of the ability of the hospitals to gain modern equipment, possibility for the Iraqi people to combat epidemic disease, and the consequences of depleted uranium.
Against all odds, the resistance of the oppressed. No let-up in anti-war protests. That is the report of the news on March 30th. Protesters across the world are taking to the streets to end the U.S.-led war against Iraq. Rallies in Europe, the Americas, and China. Indonesia, 250,000 people in the streets. Santiago, Mexico City, Montevideo, Buenos Aires, Caracas, Bogota, Lima, throughout Germany, and a human chain in Germany as 40,000 protesters gathered between the northern cities of Münster and Osnabrück, 35 miles apart, and in Berlin. Now let's look at Turkey, where the United States had hoped to send troops and to send those troops into the north of Iraq. In Turkey, on March 21st, trade unions organized in Istanbul, İsmet, Tunceli, and Diyarbakır acted upon the call to stop work against the war. And the communications workers union stopped work also for an hour, with chanting no to the slavery code, no to war, peace right now, down with U.S. imperialism. And then for 2 hours, the transport workers in İzmir stopped work. The energy workers trade union stopped work in Istanbul. They sent a clear message to the Turkish government. Workers will be out on the streets if Turkey goes ahead with the role of U.S. imperialism.
Work stoppage, resistance to war, the spreading resistance across the Iraq, the heroic resistance of the Iraqi people, the passion that it arouses in the oppressed Arab masses. Resistance to war in the United States, too. Resistance to war, brothers and sisters, at the point of production. Resistance to war at the ports of this country. Resistance to war by the dock workers of this country. Resistance to imperialism, described so eloquently in the Washington Post on March 29th, which is with its description of the resignation of Richard Pearl. Pearl's resignation is not a cure, and it goes on to describe how Republicans and Democrats alike are profiteering from the imperial war, that the Global Crossing deal encompasses all of the major figures of the Bush and the Clinton administration alike. Thomas Mack McCarthy, the chief of staff of Clinton's White House, stated that the fee arrangements are not unusual. They are across the board. It is the capitalist ruling class that inflicts this genocide. It is that to which we must resist.
You've been listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, Against All Odds, the Resistance of the Oppressed. If you would like a copy, please contact us for CD or audio cassette, 212-209-2953, or at takingaim@patbell.net. We'll be with you next week.
Taking Aim with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen, back next week at 5 p.m. You are tuned to WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM.